understand Epiphany. You have to understand the whole plan of the Gospel of Matthew. He wrote the Gospel to address this critical question at that time, around the year 85. Who is a real Jew? Who is a real Jew? The Jews who accepted Jesus as Messiah, or the Jews who did not accept Jesus as Messiah? So he made up this little story where he again pointed out what he saw as the central problem of the Jews who did not accept Jesus, namely their hypocrisy. Over and over again in the Gospel of Matthew, he has Jesus calling the Jews hypocrites. So, as I said, he made up this little story to say, it's the pagans who recognize Jesus as the fulfillment of Judaism. Just like Luke make up his little story about singing angels and shepherds to make his point that Jesus was above all there for the poor. The shepherds, of course, were the dregs of society. This is a typical biblical usage called midrash, where they create these little stories to educate people, to point out as clearly as they can what was going on. And of course, the failure of the Jews, from Matthew's point of view, was that they did not do what God had called them to do in the first place. It was precisely to be God's invitation to everybody. Everybody. And their failure, of course, was precisely to be exclusive. To be shutting all kinds of people out. Make very clear demarcation. You're in, you're out. You're good, you're bad. Matthew said, that's all nonsense. Distraction, falsity. So, that's what we're celebrating today, God's universal mercy. So it sort of puts even to more puzzling light all this muttering about a smaller, purer church. You know, I don't know where you go with that. It seems to me to fly directly in the face of the Matthean message that the church as the new Jerusalem is supposed to be there for the invitation to everybody to salvation. Okay. So, today I'm going to do what I've been doing for the last 40 years at the end of the Christmas season, which is what Karl Rahner said preachers always should do, and I don't, and he did even less well than I think. Named to be a poet. The homilist is supposed to be a poet. Well, all you have to do is read Rahner, and you see his language is anything but poetic. So I'm going to read again for the 40th time this conclusion of this magnificent poetry play by W.H. Auden called For the Time Being. So we've gone through the entire nativity story with the star talking, the shepherds talking, Mary talking, Joseph talking, Herod talking, everybody. And so the narrator who's standing alongside this whole business concludes with these words. Well, so that is that. Now we must dismantle the tree, putting the decorations back into their boxes, into their cardboard boxes. Some have got broken. And carrying them up to the attic. The holly and the mistletoe must be taken down and burned. And the children got ready for school. There are enough leftovers to do, warmed up, for the rest of the week. Not that we had much appetite, having drunk such a lot. Stayed up so late, attempted, quite unsuccessfully, to love all of our relatives. And in general, grossly overestimated our powers. Once again, as in previous years, we have seen the actual vision and failed to do more than entertain it as an agreeable possibility. Once again, we have sent him away, begging, though, to remain his disobedient servant. The promising child who cannot keep his word for long. The Christmas feast is already a fading memory, and already the mind begins to be vaguely aware of an unpleasant whiff of apprehension at the thought of Lent and Good Friday, which cannot, after all, now be very far off. But for the time being, here we all are, back in the moderate Aristotelian city of Darning in the 815, where Euclid's geometry and Newton's mechanics would account for our experience. And the kitchen table exists because I scrub it. It seems to have shrunk during the holidays. The streets are much narrower than we remember it. We'd forgotten the office was as depressing as this. To those who have seen a child, however dimly, however incredulously, the time being is, in a sense, the most trying time of all. For the innocent children who whispered so excitedly outside the locked door where they knew the presence to be grew up when it opened. Now, recollecting the moment, we can repress the joy, but the guilt remains conscious. Remembering the stable where for once in our lives everything became a you and nothing was an it. And craving the sensation, but ignoring the cause, we look around for something, no matter what, to inhibit our self-reflection. And the obvious thing for that purpose would be some great suffering. So, once we've met the Son, we're tempted ever after to pray to the Father, lead us into temptation and evil for our sake. They will come, all right, don't worry, probably in a form that we do not expect, and certainly with a force more dreadful than we can imagine. In the meantime, there are bills to be paid, machines to keep in repair, irregular verbs to learn, the time being to redeem from insignificance. The happy morning is over, the night of agony still to come. The time is noon, when the spirit must practice his scales of rejoicing without even a hostile audience. And the soul endure a silence that is neither for nor against her faith that God's will be done. That in spite of her prayers, God will cheat no one, not even the world of its triumph. And the chorus concludes, "He is the way. Follow him to the land of unlikeness. You will see rare beasts and have unique adventures. He is the truth. Seek him in the kingdom of anxiety. You'll come to a great city that has expected your return for years. He is the life. Love him in the world of the flesh. And at your marriage, all its occasions shall dance for joy."